Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
I'm Joe Moore. On today's program, what's a yellow submarine doing at the bottom of Lake Tahoe? We'll find out with a report from Amy Quinton. We'll also talk to a guest from the British magazine The Economist, which last Friday published a set of stories about the San Joaquin Valley. We'll get an international perspective on our local issues with journalist Tom Nuttall. And later in the show, find out how you can participate in a new crowdsourced exhibit taking place at the Fresno Art Museum by attending a photo walk this Saturday in downtown Fresno. We'll get the details from the Fresno Art Museum's Linda Cano. But first, we turn our attention to lawmakers in Sacramento. After spending a month working around their home districts, California Assembly members are back at the Capitol to finish up the last 6 weeks of the legislative session. As Katie Orr reports from Sacramento, there's no shortage of things to get done.
Members of the California Assembly buzz around the chamber like kids just back to school after a long summer break. Colleagues greet each other and catch up, having spent a month away from Sacramento on summer recess. And like a stern teacher, Speaker Pro Tem Nora Campos had to ask everyone to settle down.
Members, can we give our attention to Ms. Atkins, please?
But Assembly Minority Leader Connie Conway says the excitement will soon give way to a more studious atmosphere.
It's like the first day of school. It's good to be back and see everybody, but there's homework. Lots of homework, and then there's really big tests.
Tests on a variety of subjects in just 6 weeks. Assembly Speaker John Perez.
We have roughly 1,100 bills between the two houses that are still active.
Which bills receive top priority depends on who you talk to. Steve Smith is with the California Labor Federation. He says his organization is pushing to protect immigrant workers from employer retaliation.
Immigrant workers are, I think, some of the most vulnerable workers in California to this sort of exploitation. So we think, in addition to federal immigration reform, this is an important safeguard for workers in California.
Several environment issues will also garner a lot of attention. Dan Jacobson is with Environment California. He's keeping an eye on a possible overhaul of the California Environmental Quality Act.
CEQA is probably the best environmental law in the country for keeping California looking like it's supposed to look. And there's plenty of developers and others that want to try to make changes and run roughshod over the great environmental quality laws that we have.
Jacobson may not have to worry. Perez says he's not optimistic any significant changes will be made to CEQA this year. He does expect a vigorous debate about fracking, which is a controversial method for extracting oil and gas from the earth. He supports the final surviving bill, which calls for strict regulation of the industry.
And I think it's in line with a narrow majority, but a majority nonetheless, of the people of California that are very concerned about the implications of fracking.
Several business issues are also likely to draw some attention. Governor Jerry Brown is working with labor and business groups on paying back the $10 billion the state's unemployment trust fund currently owes the federal government. A measure approved by the Assembly and pending in the Senate would increase the state's minimum wage. Smith says that's a priority for labor, too. He notes California's minimum wage hasn't gone up in 5 years.
We've been outpaced by neighboring states, including Washington, Oregon, and Nevada, when it comes to minimum wage. We're way behind.
And Republican Leader Conway says you can't forget about bills that may have been defeated, only to be brought back to life through something called the gut and amend process.
Gut and amend just doesn't even sound nice, does it? So they are gutting one bill, so they have a vehicle, the bill that's already made it through, and it's here. You just take the guts out, you take the content out, and you stick something else in.
Conway says, as a member of the minority party, it's something she's always on the lookout for, though she admits it doesn't happen as much as it used to.
Clerk will open the roll. All members vote who desire to vote.
Whatever does come up, Capitol watchers paint the end of session as a frantic time, with lawmakers rushing to get their legislation passed. The Assembly is already on its way. The Senate will join the sprint to the finish when it returns from its summer break next week. At the State Capitol, I'm Katie Orr.
Valley Edition. Right now in Afghanistan, infants who otherwise might die are getting a new chance at life at a neonatal department at Afshar Hospital in Kabul. The 24-bed nursery was constructed by a Fresno-based nonprofit organization called AMOR, which stands for American Medical Overseas Relief. Here to tell us more about this story is Davina Witcher. She is the development director for AMOR and will be traveling back to Afghanistan at the end of August. Davina, welcome.
Thank you.
Tell me how this organization got its start working in Afghanistan and at this hospital.
Absolutely. This organization was conceived in 2004 when a woman who had a passion and understanding for the medical need in Afghanistan approached local businessmen and farmers about an opportunity to build a clinic there. And so a representative was sent from Fresno, and after seeing the immense need, the decision was made to acquire land and to build not a clinic but a full hospital. And so that process of construction started in 2005. Shortly thereafter, it was realized that a 501c3 nonprofit needed to be established in order to raise funds for the ongoing project and provide administrative oversight. So AMOR was designated as a nonprofit in 2008, and the hospital opened its doors and started treating patients in April of 2009.
An amazing story indeed. This is something that is of great need in that part of the world. Obviously, we all know about the aftermath of the conflicts in Afghanistan and the challenges there. But specifically when it comes to neonatal care, when it comes to medicine in general, that's a huge issue that sometimes we don't hear about much in the press, in the media. We hear about the struggles of the economy. We hear about the struggles of the war and conflicts there. But tell us a little more about why is this needed in Kabul with this hospital, and what are some of the things that you're seeing on the ground?
Sure. First of all, in 2008, when the hospital opened, one out of 8 women were dying from complications related to childbirth. One out of 5 children were dying from preventable and treatable diseases. So there was a huge need for basic medical care, what you and I consider everyday care that we go to our physician to receive without a second thought. And this was lacking because the medical facilities in the country are either governmental and don't have a lot of funding, and the quality of physicians in those facilities could be improved, or there were private hospitals which were very expensive and not easily accessible to the common people. So Afshar Hospital was built with the design of providing maternal child care to the very poorest regions on a fee-for-service scale that was affordable but also provided the hospital with sustainability. So we started with providing pre- and postnatal care, vaccines, vitamins, micronutrient nutrition. We opened a maternity department that was able to provide free birthing services. We've now upscaled that to the point that we employ 5 OBGYN specialist females that staff that department, in addition to 13 midwives and maternity nurses, so that women are able to come in and respect their culture of only receiving care from other women, but at the same time can receive maternity care that is the same design as Western medicine would provide. And then as far as the neonatal department, this has been a personal passion of mine, having worked at Children's Hospital in the neonatal department there, recognizing the tremendous need that we have here in our valley, and then having an opportunity to address that same care that and need in an environment where there was no other nursery facilities. Kabul has one other neonatal nursery at a local hospital. And so after visiting that hospital, we decided at Afshar that we would go ahead and pursue the opportunity of building a nursery that was based more on Western-style care. And then we took about a year and a half to hire pediatricians who had neonatal experience, provide them additional online education and that type of thing. So when we opened the nursery in February 2013, we were able to provide a level of service that is comparable to what we here in the U.S. would consider a level 2 nursery.
You're not just building this hospital or building beds. You're operating this facility, right?
The facility has been operating since April 2009. So when it began operations, we were seeing 700 patients a month at this 100-bed facility. We now average 3,500 patients a month, so it has significantly grown.
So you started out with the regular hospital, then you added the neonatal ward and continue to grow.
Exactly.
These aren't doctors from the U.S. or Europe. These are Afghan doctors treating Afghans, correct?
Absolutely. So our model is built on Afghans helping Afghans. So all of our employees are Afghan, and that's 150 employees, a third of which are women. And each one, we try to be non-discriminate in where, what tribe they come from, what economic background, so that we can show to the community that we treat everyone that is in need of services without any type of political or religious affiliation.
Building and operating a facility like Afshar Hospital has to be expensive. What does it take to keep this going in terms of dollars?
Sure. Well, it's probably less expensive than you would imagine. Our operating budget is about $4.1 million a year, and we take care of 40,000 patients a year with that budget. So when you break that down, it comes down to about $15 per person, and we're able to provide everything from all the prenatal care services, all the maternity services. We have a full surgical ward. We have a full emergency department. We have inpatients department, then the neonatal nursery, the community. So the plethora of medical services that we're able to provide for $4 million a year is incredible.
Has it been a challenge to try to recruit those individuals and to also provide that training in an area like Kabul?
In some ways, it's been a challenge in that it's there's not a lot of medical staff that has pursued that specialty on their own. So in that way, it was a challenge. On the other hand, Afshar Hospital has been open long enough, and we have a reputation in the region for promoting education and for being a center of excellence. And so from that regard, when we've got close to the nursery being open, those people that were like-minded with us and wanted to serve their fellow Afghans, they sought out our hospital and the opportunity to work there. So we were very blessed by the people that applied.
We'll talk about the future plans in a moment, because I know that this is not a book where we've reached the last chapter. There's still more work to be done. But this would be your third or fourth trip to Afghanistan?
This upcoming one will be my fourth.
Your fourth trip to Afghanistan. Your first one came in 2010. What was your first impression setting foot on Afghan soil?
It was not my first time to travel out of the country into impoverished areas, and still the overwhelming feeling of seeing the abject poverty and the conditions that the people, even in this large city, was living in was overwhelming. The conditions of clean water, clean food, the sewage, the trash situation, the lack of paved roads and infrastructure. It just was almost non-existent in 2010. And so since that time, and going back on a regular basis, I've been able to see the roads paved, the trash removed, new construction underway, been able to see the condition of women everywhere improved, the condition of young people and children in the schools that are provided, and the opportunities for education. And it's wonderful to see the great strides that they're making there.
Have you been concerned about your security there?
Not really. When I go, I try to be respectful of the culture, and then I cover my head and I don't walk around by myself. I always have an escort. But other than that, I travel freely where I wish to go. And no, I haven't been concerned, no.
We were talking about the need in Afghanistan, and there's a stat that I want to talk about, and that's the percentage of births that take place outside of a traditional hospital that we think of. Can you talk about that and explain what that means in terms of the care that you're trying to provide and some of the implications that are involved?
Sure. So one of the amazing stats that exists in 2012 is that 80% of the women in Afghanistan still deliver their children at home without any type of medical assistance. And so that is partly because of their lack of transportation to medical facilities and also some cultural barriers that come with the fact that the mother-in-law has traditionally been the one to provide those types of services in the home. So you have to reach an educational level with these women to teach them why it's important to come to a hospital. And if they do not have the means to travel to the hospital, then how to provide the safest environment for themselves and their newborn in their home. So what Amore has done is address this on a couple of levels. We have a community outreach and patient education program that travels to a different home within five rural communities surrounding Kabul, goes there each day of the week, goes to a different home, and sets up a clinic for women where they're free to walk or to come to the clinic in any way they have are able. And there they can receive prenatal care, postnatal care, all their vitamins, vaccines, nutritional supplements in order to support their own health so that they can deliver a healthy baby. We also recognize that there are women who still cannot overcome the challenges of coming to the hospital. And so in that regard, we have clean birthing kits that have been provided to by AmeriCares to us, which is one of our great supporters of gift and kind donations. And these kits provide a clean area for the mother to deliver, a sterile scalpel so that they can cut the umbilical cord, hand sanitation, gloves, the very basics. So even though they're in their home, we can create a small, clean environment for the mother and the baby to be born in.
Kabul is a large city. I imagine the need is far greater than even what your organization has been able to do to date. What are the plans moving forward?
Sure. So we've been able to establish a couple of really good programs. The one of which I was just speaking about is this community outreach and patient education. We currently see five different areas, and we are currently treating about 1,400 women a month in this program, significantly grown from about 200 when we first started in 2010. So the plan is to grow the community outreach and patient education program. And we would like to see as many women as possible and add not only to the staff but to the different areas that we can go to, because this is a much-needed service and easily provided to women who cannot come to the hospital. We're also growing the neonatal nursery. The capacity of what we have built is 24 beds. We are still looking for donations in order to bring all of the equipment that we need into that area to educate the community about the availability of this service and the affordability of this service. And thirdly, we're looking into partnering with another foundation that is very active in Afghanistan to develop a telemedicine program through their clinic system that reaches even more rural areas so that we're able to use the expertise of the physicians that we have at Afshar Hospital to reach even more women who would not have the ability to seek that care at all.
We look at the relatively comfortable lives that we live with here in the U.S. and Western medicine and facilities like Children's Hospital, and a world away is Kabul and this facility that Amore is running, and in some ways those are worlds apart, but I imagine there's also some similarities that you see. Talk about that.
So I would say
humanity is humanity, is it not?
Absolutely, and well said. And I would first say that the similarities are far outnumber the differences. The Afghan people have been in a state of conflict for 30 years. And so you can imagine from the perspective of mothers and fathers, they want the very same things that mothers and fathers here want. They want the opportunity for peace, to be able to provide enough food and water for their children, the opportunity for education, to have work, to better their lives for the next generation.
Our guest has been Davina Witcher. She is the development director for a Fresno-based nonprofit called Amore. The organization has built a 100-bed hospital in Kabul, Afghanistan. Their latest project is a 24-bed neonatal department at Afshar Hospital in Kabul. Davina will be traveling back to Afghanistan at the end of August to supervise the next steps in this organization's service to the Afghan community. Davina, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition on FM 89. If you're planning on taking a late summertime trip to Lake Tahoe, be prepared for a surprise. An unmanned robotic submarine designed to explore Antarctica has taken a detour to the famous mountain lake. Its mission is to study the deepest earthquake fault line, more than 1,000 feet beneath the surface of the lake. It's an area geologists have never seen before. But as Amy Quinton reports from Sacramento, they still haven't.
Thousands of years ago, a powerful earthquake shifted the ground beneath Lake Tahoe 12 to 20 feet vertically, spawning a giant tsunami. That's what geologists believe happened, but they don't know the details or the exact magnitude. But Gordon Seitz with the California Geological Survey says it's important to find out.
The thing that does have us somewhat concerned here at Lake Tahoe is that the last large earthquake appears to have happened about 4,000 years ago. And that's about the average return time.
Site says if it were to happen again, the tsunami would have devastating consequences.
That wave would, you know, travel around the entire lake. And because the lake is shaped sort of like a bathtub, it would bounce back and forth off the different shores for hours.
The only way to learn more is to go where no one has gone before, 1,000 feet down to the lake's deepest fault line.
About an inch on this side, Kevin.
On a barge on the western side of Lake Tahoe, crews hoist a one-ton, 28-foot cylindrical submarine with a crane into the cold water. The unmanned sub is armed with high-definition cameras, acoustic sensors that provide X-ray-like views of sediments below the lake floor, and other high-tech devices. After hours of tinkering with a ruptured hydraulic tube, its systems are tested in the water. The project is the creation of geologist Ross Powell with Northern Illinois University, who has been working on it for more than 8 years. The goal is to eventually submerge the vessel into the waters beneath the ice sheets of Antarctica to study changes associated with global warming.
It's going down about 800 meters or 2,500 feet through the ice. We've calculated that. That's about two Empire State Buildings through the ice.
He said through the ice. This sub can collapse like a torpedo to a width of just 22 inches. Lake Tahoe is its big test. Powell waits anxiously for its transformation.
This is it.
we're gonna scissor it now, okay? I'll go around to the other side. Okay,
we'll this is what we've been waiting for all day. It's doing it.
The sub transforms from a horizontal to a vertical position successfully. But then there's a problem.
All stop ACU, all stop ACU. All stop.
We blew something.
Yep.
What's your load?
Another hydraulic tube busted. But Powell isn't discouraged.
That's better to find out now than when we're off in a really deep site and then we have to recover it from there. So. Always thinking positive.
Okay, enable hydraulics.
After another day of testing, the researchers encountered more problems, not with the submarine itself, but with defective manufactured parts. Ultimately, the sub never made it down to the lake's deepest earthquake fault line. But Powell says he's confident it will work in Antarctica. With a little luck and a little more funding, the sub will come back to Lake Tahoe next summer. Then, geologists can finally see evidence of the last big earthquake, and they hope understand what dangers the next one will bring. In Sacramento, I'm Amy Quinton.
Vertical's 100% down. You're listening to Valley Edition. The acquittal of George Zimmerman and the death of Trayvon Martin has sparked a national dialogue about race and justice. In this edition of Valley Public Radio's commentary series, The Moral Is, Ida Jones, a business law professor at Fresno State, says the verdict makes her question our nation's commitment to the principles of justice and fairness.
What happened to the principles of justice and fairness the U.S. was supposed to represent? I'm speaking to you as a black parent of three sons and a daughter. 25 years ago, when my sons were younger, I taught them to wait inside stores and businesses for me, not outside, because I knew groups of black teenaged males automatically drew suspicion from police. It never seriously occurred to me that they could have been killed by anyone who thought they might be doing something wrong. Yet Zimmerman's acquittal for killing Trayvon Martin means just that, that any one of my sons could have been killed if they'd been walking in the gated community of family or friends, wearing a hoodie, and had reacted to being followed by an unfamiliar white man. I'm grateful that they are law-abiding adults now. At the same time, I wonder whether they'll ever be safe. The jury's decision represents another step in our country's continued decline in its commitment to principles of equality of opportunity, fairness, and justice for everyone regardless of color, and its increased movement toward opportunity based on money and color. I've been a member of the legal community for more than 36 years. I chose the legal profession because I saw the law as a way to remedy the injustices that existed after the civil rights laws were adopted in the 60s. Although I knew changing laws doesn't immediately change attitudes, I believed the legal profession would be instrumental to implement changes that reduced discrimination and promoted universal justice and fairness. But that clock seems to have turned back, as evidenced by acquittal of Martin's killer, many states' adoption of stand-your-ground laws that justify killing for reasons other than true self-defense, and the current spate of voter registration laws that limit access to the right to vote. I despair that in fundamental ways, the legal system has returned to pre-civil rights times. Long-deceased Supreme Court Justice Taney's words in the Dred Scott decision more than 140 years ago ring in my ears, that black men have no rights that society need respect. I'm a U.S. citizen who thought the U.S. was an example of an enlightened country where a person's skin color was irrelevant to his or her rights to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. The Zimmerman jury's decision makes it clear that the victim's color is key to the right to life. If one is a black male teenager walking in a white neighborhood, he must immediately surrender to any stranger following him, or he can be killed and the killer will go free. What a significant departure from the principles of justice and fairness that the U.S. is supposed to represent. For The Moral Is, this is Ida Jones.
The commentary series The Moral Is was produced by Valley Public Radio in association with the Bonner Center for Character Education at California State University, Fresno. The opinions expressed are those of the writer and not necessarily Valley Public Radio. Send us your comments with an email. The address is talk@kvpr.org.
I'm Ezra Romero with these news headlines. For more than 4 years, California's been borrowing money from the federal government to help pay out unemployment benefits. As Katie Orr reports from Sacramento, the state's now considering how to repay its debt.
The Great Recession hurt California in many ways, including decimating the fund it uses to pay unemployment benefits. The state owes the federal government $10 billion that it borrowed to cover a gap in its unemployment trust fund. For the last 2 years, it's had to pay interest on the loan, this year more than $260 million. Now that its finances are looking up, California is beginning to think about paying back its debt. Governor Jerry Brown's administration is working with business and labor groups to come up with a legislative fix by possibly increasing employer contributions, decreasing benefits, or both. While benefits have increased over time, California has not increased the required contribution from employers since 1984. At the state capitol, I'm Katie Orr.
State officials have launched an investigation into a demolition accident at a former PG&E power plant in Bakersfield, which injured several bystanders on Saturday. Demolition contractors had planned to use explosives to topple two large structures at the plant just south of Rosedale Highway and Coffee Road. But the blast sent debris and shrapnel beyond the 1,000-foot safety zone set up by officials, striking people who had gathered to watch the explosion. One curious onlooker at a local store was seriously injured, having his leg amputated, and four others also sustained injuries. Erica Monterosa, spokeswoman with Cal OSHA, says that an order to preserve the grounds where the demolition happened is in place.
We're going to be looking at the companies, exactly what occurred, as well as the company's safety procedures for their work sites, to determine whether there were any violations of California's occupational safety and health regulations.
Monte Rosa says that if evidence of neglect or fault are found, then Alpha Explosives, the responsible employer, will be fined up to $25,000 for a serious violation. And if willful intent is found, the company will be fined up to $70,000.
If there were violations, it's the employer that will be cited, and there will be monetary penalties assessed depending on the nature of the violation. And the employer will also have to correct those violations within a specific time period.
The investigation will include interviews with workers and witnesses, a review of safety records, as well as lab analysis if needed. Cal OSHA has up to 6 months to finish their review. California Governor Jerry Brown's office released a report Monday dealing with the economic impact of the proposed Bay Delta Conservation Plan. Dr. David Sunding in the Department of Agricultural and Resource Economics at UC Berkeley helped author the report.
Taking all the positives and all the negatives from a strict economic welfare point of view, our conclusion is that the BDCP does clearly pass a cost-benefit test. To the tune of something like $5 billion.
Additionally, the report estimates the plan will create around 177,000 jobs. Barbara Barragan-Perea is executive director of Restore the Delta. She says the report misrepresents the cost of the project.
The figures put on disruption to the Delta, Delta fisheries, Delta recreation, the Delta economies, as usual, are completely understated.
The Bay Delta Conservation Plan will cost around $25 billion over its 50-year lifespan. It is said to be the second largest public works project in California history. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra Romero.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. 3 years ago, The Economist published an article that chronicled the toll the Great Recession had taken on the people and the economy of the San Joaquin Valley, calling the region the Appalachia of the West. Last week, the UK-based publication published another set of articles about the region. Here to tell us more about what he saw during his travels through the valley is journalist Tom Nuttall. He is the U.S. West Coast correspondent for The Economist. Tom, welcome.
Good morning.
Tom, when you write for an international audience, your readers probably think of California as Silicon Valley, as movie stars. How do you explain this part of the state to people who have no idea it even exists?
That's a good question. I mean, you're absolutely right. When people outside of the U.S., I think even when people outside of California think of the state, it's Silicon Valley, it's the Bay Area, or it's Los Angeles beaches and glamour. Now, here's a big part of the state that a lot of people have never heard of, certainly. Give no thought to. So, I mean, the way into it, I think, is to begin talking about agriculture, which is obviously the economic base of the region, has been for a very long time, the breadbasket of the nation, producing half of its fruit and vegetables. That's a way to start talking about it. But the thing that often surprises people once they become aware of the existence of the Central Valley is to find out just how different life is there from what they're a bit more familiar with on the coasts.
I've heard many people, both those who live in this area and from outside, describe this area as something of an island from the rest of California, both physically, both in its economy, in terms of its politics, in terms of its culture, and a lot of these issues. You kind of talk about that in your article, Down on the Farms, and the connections or the lack of connections between this part of the state and the rest of California. What did you see in that regard in your travels?
I mean, that's certainly true. Obviously, the most obvious way in which the region is disconnected from the rest of the state is geographical. You have mountain ranges on either side and a different sort of geology from the rest of the state. But as you say, there's a cultural disconnection there as well. I mean, as you're traveling through, I was driving through a couple of weeks ago, listening to the radio, I was hearing things that I would never imagine that I would hear in California. Certainly you don't get it here in Los Angeles where I'm based. Politically, it's very different, of course. This is one of the last regions in California where people still vote Republican, or a good number of people vote Republican anyway. So you have a geographical disconnection, which has perhaps bred social and political disconnection, and to a certain extent, an economic disconnection as well.
The economy is certainly a big issue, something that you cover with your magazine. And the Valley's ag economy is, by all accounts, doing rather well. As crop values have soared, so have the economic numbers in the agriculture sector. However, that hasn't translated to the jobs arena as much as many here in this area would like. Back in 2010, The Economist published this article titled "The San Joaquin Valley, Appalachia of the West." It wasn't the first time that somebody had made that comparison, but it certainly rung true with many here in this part of the state. Do you feel that comparison is still accurate 3 years later?
I'm sorry to say, but I think it probably still is. I mean, it's curious. As I was making my way through the valley, that phrase emerged a number of times with people that I was speaking to. And what I often found is there's this sort of pugnacious pride that a lot of people up and down the valley feel in the place that they come from, whether it's the valley as a whole or actually more often their hometown or their home city. So I'd encountered people who were rather irate that they would be looked down on in this way and described as the Appalachia of the West. But then very often what would happen would be almost in the same breath, they would acknowledge that it was not an unreasonable description of the area when you look at a whole range of indicators. So you look at education outcomes, you look at incomes, you look at health, you look at out-migration, all of these things. There's this vast, this stark difference between what's happening in most parts of the valley and in other parts of California. And there's a statistic that I give in the piece. A couple of years ago, this organization called Measure for America put together a sort of human development index for California, and they divided the state into several regions. The best performing region was the Bay Area, which was on a par with Connecticut, which was the best performing state. The lowest performing was the San Joaquin Valley, which was on a par with West Virginia, which was the lowest performing state.
Tell me a little about your trip to this part of California. I understand you were here for a number of days and talked to a lot of different people. Maybe if you can relate some of the stories of the people that you talked to in California, in Central Valley.
Sure. Well, the sort of conceit for what I was doing was driving the route of the proposed high-speed rail link. So I started off at Union Station in Los Angeles and went all the way through the valley, well, up to Modesto anyway, and then went back to the coast via San Jose and ultimately in San Francisco. So I was partly looking specifically at what high-speed rail might mean for the valley. Obviously, construction is due to begin within the next couple of months, and it's meant to provide a direct stimulus to the valley through construction jobs. But I also wanted to get a broader sense of how things were going in the valley economically. And one of the most striking things I found was talking to officials or workforce development types or some employers, so people whose job it is to be sort of professionally optimistic about prospects in the valley. Repeatedly in several different cities, I found a sort of a weary sort of fatalism that the region was facing problems that had been around for decades, perhaps over a century. So problems to do with educational attainment, problems to do with a low-skilled workforce, problems to do with skilled and talented and ambitious not being able to find opportunities in the valley and leaving as soon as they have a chance. And it was striking how almost sort of repetitive these conversations were, everywhere from Fresno up through Modesto to Merced. There was one minor exception, which was at the beginning of the trip in Bakersfield. There was noticeably more optimism there, largely as a result of the commodity boom that we've had in the last few years. Obviously, Bakersfield, Kern County, a big oil area, and also increasingly relevant in renewable energy. So there was slightly more optimism there, although Kern County obviously faces a lot of the same problems that other counties in the valley do as well.
If you just joined us on Valley Edition today, our guest is journalist Tom Nuttall. He is the U.S. West Coast correspondent for The Economist.
Several articles about the Central Valley appeared in last week's issue that's available on newsstands now. And Tom, you've been talking about the economic issues and a lot of the challenges this area faces. When you talk to politicians, when you talk to some of those economic development people, they will cite high-speed rail as a potential solution and a way to grow the economy, bring in knowledge workers, have people commute to work on the coast and live here in this part of the state. However, you talk to agriculture people and others in the valley, and they say high-speed rail will be the end of this region. It'll destroy agriculture. It's going to bankrupt the state, et cetera, et cetera. How do you see high-speed rail impacting this region's economy moving forward, beyond this, the construction?
Sure. I mean, well, you're absolutely right, of course. There's a huge disconnect between the way that a lot of officials see this project and the response of a lot of people in the agricultural industry. Now, obviously, a huge public work scheme like this is going to have a major impact on land, and a lot of the land that it will impact is productive agricultural land. I'm not sure it's reasonable to say that a scheme like this would destroy agriculture in the Central Valley.
Yeah, that might be an exaggeration.
There's certainly people who will tell you that. I met some of them. Some of the skepticism towards this project is skepticism that you're likely to see towards any vast government-backed scheme like this. I mean, this is absolutely huge, this thing. It's costed at $68 billion, and, you know, if it follows the iron law of big infrastructure projects, and that will certainly go up when construction begins, the biggest infrastructure project in the history of California by most measures. Now, as you said, construction will begin in the Central Valley. There will be a direct stimulus effect through the creation of construction jobs in the ancillary industry. So the figure that they give is 20,000 jobs a year for 5 years in the initial construction phase. What's far more difficult to know, of course, is what the medium to long-term effects of connecting the valley to the major metropolitan areas on the coast would be once the thing is actually up and running. So one economist that I spoke to in the Bay Area, who I mentioned in the piece, he's actually very skeptical, or has been very skeptical, about the potential economic impact of the project on the valley. What he says it could do is actually help employers in places like Silicon Valley by relieving housing costs. So, for example, if it becomes viable to commute from, say, Gilroy into San Jose or to Palo Alto, then those people who are working for Google who aren't on million-dollar salaries will be able to commute to that job and be able to buy affordable housing in places further east, further inland. So that's one potential economic impact. But further down the line, it's hard to know. And obviously, there's a lot of people, particularly in the valley, who think that who are very skeptical about the chances of those later phases of construction ever taking place, given that the funding isn't in place. Now, you talk to officials from the High Speed Rail Authority, they're not worried about this at all. They say there'll be plenty of private money that's forthcoming once they show that this is a viable project. But, you know, this is a long way down the road, and big infrastructure projects like this do have a habit of not following the expectations that we have for them.
Before we go, Tom, one last question. You cite UC Merced as one ray of hope for this part of California. Certainly, we already see that housing prices are coming back up in this area, and that the residential economy is starting to boom, and that was really what fueled our last time that we had unemployment below double digits in this part of the state. What do you see for the future?
Well, that's a
crystal
good
ball, yeah.
I mean, you're right. UC Merced, that came up regularly in conversations that I had. Now, it's early days. People had big hopes for that campus when it opened in 2005, and obviously it was only a couple of years later that the area was hit by a huge housing crash from which it's only recovering now. But there are signs that that campus is starting to forge links with industry in certain areas, solar energy, biotech, and that I'm told that there may be some spin-off companies in the works. A couple of people like to compare it to UC Davis, which has become a major center for agricultural research. If Merced can find its own niche or niches, then it may be able to follow in the footsteps of Davis further north. So that's one potential bright spot. I mean, I think we just had the conversation, but you can't talk about the future of the Valley without talking about high-speed rail. We hope that at least in the construction phase, that the stimulus effect from the money that will be coming in and all the jobs that will be created will have a significant impact in the area. And I mean, another theme that came up with a whole bunch of people that I spoke to is that the Valley needs to capitalize on its strengths. And when we think about agriculture, you said earlier that although the sector has been performing strongly and exports are doing well, the jobs haven't necessarily followed, and that is true. There are a whole bunch of industries that are close to farming. So food processing is one, particularly in the northern parts of the valley, that might present opportunities for growth. Irrigation. When I was talking to people about Fresno, they spoke about the comparative advantage of the region for companies involved in water technologies. So these are possible areas for growth. But in the long term, really, I think the only answer is education. Educational outcomes in the Valley are very poor. High school graduation rates are low. You have this big brain drain, as I was mm-hmm. mentioning before. Mm-hmm. What you really need to see in the Valley is an increased emphasis on providing opportunities for kids who are just beginning their schooling.
Well, indeed, it's interesting to hear an international perspective on the issues we deal with every day. Our guest on Valley Edition has been Tom Nuttall. He is the U.S. West Coast correspondent for The Economist. You can read his articles about the San Joaquin Valley in the latest issue, available on newsstands now. Tom, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Valley Edition. It's one thing to go to a museum or gallery and stroll the halls contemplating the art hanging on the walls. It's another to participate in an event where you create the art that winds up in the museum. And that's the goal of a new project from the Fresno Art Museum, Spectrum Gallery, and the Downtown Fresno Partnership. It's called the Downtown Visions Photo Walk, and it's taking place this Saturday evening. Linda Cano joins us now from the Fresno Art Museum to tell us more. Linda, welcome.
Thank you.
What's going to be taking place this Saturday night?
Downtown, this Saturday night, we're partnering with Spectrum Gallery, which we're always so pleased to partner with them. And we've got also the Downtown Fresno Partnership. And we are meeting at the Mariposa Plaza. And we are going to have – actually, there's several elements here. The Downtown Fresno Partnership is going to have ambassadors, and they'll be giving a historical tour of downtown. Spectrum Gallery members will be on hand to give people tips on photography. I'll be there, and so will another representative of the museum. And this is all focused around our Downtown Visions exhibition coming up in September, and it'll be a chance for people to actually crowdsource an exhibition. We've never done this before, but we applied for a grant with the James Irvine Foundation, and it was a risk-taking grant, so that's kind of a unique situation, and this is kind of a risky undertaking. We don't know what we're going to get, but whoever submits something, and the subject matter is downtown vision, so it's your vision of downtown. Whether you're an artist, whether you're not, you can submit. Anyone is welcome to submit their vision. And if their vision doesn't exist right now, then you can submit what you think downtown could be or should be.
So a photo walk, just to right. step back, is an invitation for people to bring their cameras and capture what they see and what artistic statements they want to make?
Their cameras or their sketch pads. Maybe they want to make a drawing for a work of art that they want to make later. Or maybe they want to take a photograph for a painting that they want to make later. Or maybe they would like to submit a photo. So you can bring your iPhone, your sketch pad, your camera. camera, whatever you want to bring with you.
So it's not limited just to photography.
Absolutely not. No, we're accepting video. We're accepting poetry also, or dance, all sorts of things that you can send in on a video.
Why do this downtown? Why not River Park? Why not Manchester, some other part of the city?
Well, that's a great question. This is was inspired by an exhibition that we're doing with Corky Normart. And, of course, he's a Fresno icon. He's really an international artist, and we really need to celebrate what we have here in our own community, because we have some amazing artistic resources here in our own community. And Corky is one of those, I think, that really is underappreciated. An international artist, and he's actually done 50 years of downtown, and that's what inspired this whole thing. Plus, there's so much going on downtown. I mean, with from controversy to positive building. I mean, look at what Granville is doing down there, and Art Hop has just exploded. So I think as far as a topic, it's exciting, because 5 years from now, we don't know what downtown is going to look like. So this is something that everybody around here is talking about. And so it's just an interesting way to get people involved in the dialogue.
The idea of crowdsourcing an exhibit has to be very exciting and very terrifying at the same time. What is the process going to be like on the museum side in terms of putting this together? You don't know what you're going to get.
We have no idea. Well, we've already started to get some submissions. We have made there is one rule, and that's that the piece submitted has to be the size limit is 12 by 12. And thus far, the pieces that have come in have been 12 by 12. People don't seem to understand. They can be smaller, but they should be 12 by 12. If it's a video piece, it can be 90 seconds or shorter or less time. But no, we don't know. Whatever is submitted will go on the walls, as long as it's appropriate for our museum. In other words, you know, we've got kids coming through, so we got to keep that in mind. But you know, if we have to, we'll put things up salon style, floor to ceiling. And the idea is that the community joins in. We're not generating this exhibition; the community is, because we want community input. We want to be able to relate to our community.
So you want artists submitting their own framed and matted prints, or just sending you a file electronically?
It has to be original artwork that's ready to hang. So we don't want prints. We want original artwork. And again, it can be sculpture, can be three-dimensional, as long as it's 12 by 12 by 12. We're very, very excited about it.
And I also understand there's an electronic video component, some sort of video board or something involved.
Yes, there is video. And actually, that's an interesting component, because after the exhibition opens, people can continue to send in pieces to that video component. So you can get the pieces in. Our deadline is the 21st. But if you don't quite make it and you've got a video piece, you can continue to send those in, and we'll just keep adding them. And that will run on a loop.
There's a number of museums that are trying to do different things like this across
yes.
the country and increase audience engagement with the arts in a way that the traditional museum experience maybe is somewhat old-fashioned in that regard. Talk about what this means for the museum to do something different like this.
You know, we've been doing things a little bit differently. We've sort of expanded our purview. I think it's important to engage our community. We have an incredibly diverse community, and modern and contemporary art appeals to a really small segment of the population. So we've been trying to listen to our community. We've been doing some different types of shows. Thus far, our community has been responding. Our last opening had about 600 people, and the one before that had 800 attending. So we're getting our numbers up, our memberships up. So people don't want to just look at art hanging on the walls, and they don't want to have a passive experience. They want to actually engage with art and have a thoughtful experience and be part of it. They're not just satisfied to sit back and be passive anymore. So I think this is some way that people very clearly can be engaged in the process and engaged with art and make it their own. So that's what we're responding to, those sorts of needs.
Well, people can certainly bring their cameras and their sketchbooks and engage with art on their own with the Downtown Visions photo walk taking place this Saturday evening. Again, it's after the heat of the day, so
yes,
it should be a nice, cool evening, 6 to 8:30. It's starting at the Clock Tower on the Fulton Mall in Mariposa Plaza, and it's free.
It's free, yes.
Linda Cano has been our guest today on Valley Edition. She is with the Fresno Art Museum, and they are partnering with Spectrum Gallery and the Downtown Fresno Partnership for the Downtown Visions Photo Walk. Linda, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's all for this Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us, talk@kvpr.org, and follow us on Twitter @KVPR. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, and Valley Edition producer Ezra Romero, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.